This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, Craig Lubo hosts Craig Volland from the Sierra Club, who is here to speak about contamination in our food. Then Mike Murphy hosts Sarah Sarah Taliaferro, who will tell us about the art exhibit Heating Up, Artists Respond to Climate Change. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. TheGuardian.com reports February smashed a century of global temperature records by a stunning margin, according to data released by NASA. The unprecedented leap led scientists, usually wary of highlighting a single month's temperature, to label the new record a shocker and warn of a climate emergency. The NASA data shows the average global surface temperature in February was 1.35 Celsius warmer than the average temperature for the month between 1951 and 1980, a far bigger margin than ever seen before. The previous record, set just 1 month earlier in January, was 1.15 Celsius above the long-term average for that month. The UN Climate Summit in Paris in December confirmed 2C as the danger limit for global warming, which should not be passed, but it also agreed to pursue efforts to limit warming to 1.5 Celsius, a target now looking highly optimistic. Climate change is usually assessed over years and decades, and 2015 shattered the record set in 2014 for the hottest year seen, in data stretching back to 1850. The UK Met Office also expects 2016 to set a new record, meaning the global temperature record will have been broken for 3 years in a row. The record for an annual increase of atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, the main greenhouse gas, was also demolished in 2015. MidAmericaRegionalCouncil.org reports, four local governments, the cities of Kearney, North Kansas City, and Independence, Missouri, and Johnson County, Kansas, have been named Solar Ready Communities. The Mid-America Regional Council's Solar Ready Community Recognition Program honors cities and counties that implement best practices to increase the use of solar energy and take other actions to promote and facilitate solar power installation. Communities may earn bronze, silver, or gold Solar Ready Community status based on the number of actions taken. Independence earned the bronze award, Kearney earned silver, and North Kansas City and Johnson County both achieved the gold level. All four communities have included solar energy provisions in their zoning ordinances and posted solar-ready construction guidelines on their websites. Kearney took further actions to earn silver status, placing additional information about solar energy online and issuing a permit for the Platte Clay Electric Co-op's community solar installation. To achieve gold level status, both North Kansas City and Johnson County have completed solar installations at several city buildings and posted more solar information online. In addition, North Kansas City created a solar permit checklist, and Johnson County provides solar training through its contractor licensing program. MARC developed the Solar Ready Community Recognition Program as part of its Solar Ready 2 initiative, which is dedicated to making it easier for residents and businesses to use solar energy. The Solar Ready 2 program was funded by a Rooftop Solar Challenge award from the U.S. Department of Energy's SunShot Initiative. The Rooftop Solar Challenge encourages governments to reduce soft costs of solar installation, such as permits and fees. In 2015, MARC recognized 8 jurisdictions: Belton, Clay County, Gladstone, Kansas City, Lee Summit, Liberty, and Raymore, Missouri, and Shawnee, Kansas, as solar-ready communities. EcoWatch.com reports, long-term declines in the overwintering eastern population of North American monarch butterflies are significantly increasing their likelihood of becoming extinct over the next 2 decades, according to Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego and U.S. Geological Survey research published today. The new study, available in the journal Scientific Reports, found that the eastern migratory monarch population declined by 84% from the winter of 1996-97 to the winter of 2014-15. Using this information, the study demonstrated that there is a substantial chance, 11 to 57%, of quasi-extinction over the next 20 years. A quasi-extinct population is one with so few remaining individuals left that recovery is impossible. While the remaining individuals may survive for a short time, the population as a whole will inevitably go extinct. Because counting individual monarchs is challenging, scientists measure population size based on the geographic area that their colonies cover while spending the winter in Mexico. The U.S., Mexico, and Canada aim to increase the number of eastern monarchs wintering in Mexico so that they occupy about 6 hectares, or about 15 acres, by 2020. This year's population size increased substantially to about 10 acres. The population was 2.8 acres during the winter of 14-15, and at its lowest, 0.67 acres during the 2013-14 winter. The Scripps and USGS scientists found that if the eastern population reaches the 6-acre goal announced in last year's National Pollinator Strategy, the quasi-extinction risk over 20 years would decrease by more than half. And finally, Peabody Energy, the top miner of coal in the world, may soon file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The news comes as Peabody's stock closed Wednesday at a 6-month low of $2.19 per share, a 46% fall. Peabody noted its potential bankruptcy in the company's March 16 U.S. Securities Exchange Commission's Form 10-K. Peabody's announcement coincides with a recent string of tough blows faced by the coal industry, including both Arch Coals and Alpha Natural Resources filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, as well as fellow coal mining giant Foresight Energy's announcement in its recently filed Form 10-4 that it may await the same fate. The bankruptcy news does not signal, though, that humanity has reached a climate utopia. Indeed, as the U.S. Energy Information Administration reported, natural gas power generation via hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, will likely surpass coal power generation for the first time ever on the U.S. power grid. Renewables have also increased as a share of the U.S. energy grid consumption portfolio from approximately 1% in 2005 to 8% today, according to the EIA's data. Unfortunately, for advocates of a sustainable future, about 50% of that renewable energy comes from a not-so-clean and not-very renewable biomass. Quote, Peabody's bankruptcy is no different than when the banks crashed our economy in 2008, end quote, said Del Breland, St. Louis resident and member of Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment in a press release. He went on to say, quote, unless we stand up, the bankruptcy court will leave ordinary people, coal miners, and impacted communities out to dry while CEOs make millions of dollars. We are coming together to demand a true, just transition, end quote. The Just Transition theme was also expressed by the Rainforest Action Network, which noted the company is under investigation by the New York Attorney General for its climate change denial. At this time, I'd like to introduce Craig Lubo to the mic.
Okay, thank you, Naturally. And my guest today is Craig Volland. He is environmental activist in Sierra Club. He is the chair of the Ag Committee, Air Quality Committee, and then what else?
International Trade.
All right. And tonight we're talking about, as naturally indicated, we're going to talk about the issues of food contamination. And the way this issue came into view with me is that, as a lot of you may know, there was a lot of publicity this past few months relating to incidents of food poisoning at Chipotle restaurant chain. And in fact, I did some research, and they had an outbreak of norovirus at some of their restaurants, salmonella at some, and at numerous of their restaurants, including in Kansas, E. coli. And that chain was doing some special training and even closed their stores for several hours one day earlier this month, the last month, to do special training with their employees throughout the country. But their CEO was quoted in an article I saw on Yahoo, and I think it was linked to, I'm not sure who the article originated with, but the CEO was quoted as saying that they were committed to staying with organic foods, but that one of the reasons why they're more susceptible to these outbreaks is that he was saying that organic foods inherently are, it's harder to prevent, I guess, these outbreaks, that they are more easily can be more easily contaminated. So I want to start with that and have you comment on that. And what is there any truth to that or not?
No, there isn't. There's absolutely no systematic studies or evidence that indicates that organically grown vegetables are any more prone to contamination than other non-organic. I think that myth comes from the fact that organic farmers tend to use more manure on their crops, although actually that's a relatively small amount. Most organic farmers fertilize their crops with cover crops that fix nitrogen from the air. Not only that, but certified organic rules require that this manure be composted for a considerable number of months, I think it's 4 months or maybe six, to reduce any pathogen load in the manure. So that's probably where this notion comes from, but it's there's absolutely no study that has ever been, that I've ever seen or heard of, that has compared the two systematically. The other reason I'm puzzled is because I went to the Chipotle's website, and they don't actually claim to be organic. The only thing they say is that they try to get as much local produce as possible. They didn't say organic. And the other thing that really they've made their name on, and I think laudably so, is that they don't allow any hormones and antibiotics to be fed to the animals that they use for meat. And their pork is free range, which I greatly applaud compared to all the other fast food people. But they are definitely not claiming to be organic, so I don't know where that statement came from or why he thinks he could say that, because there you can look at yourself, go to their website, and I didn't find anything about that they're getting organic vegetables. So I think that's a kind of an assumption people make, but they've never claimed that.
Now, is this problem, is it more prevalent among meat, or is it more prevalent among vegetables? Is it kind of even?
Well, there's a really serious problem with the meat supply, and that is antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And the FDA has utterly failed to protect the public health in this regard. Back in after World War II in the 60s, when livestock producers started confining animals in large numbers, they, of course, came up against the problem that when you put all these animals together, that disease is going to spread. So they started feeding them antibiotics. And at the time, they also realized that antibiotics made them grow faster. And to this day, they don't exactly know why, but it has been shown, and it's true. And so they use it, have been using it not only to get their animals to grow faster, put more meat on, but also to prevent disease, which is these places are filled with the potential for disease for obvious reasons. Now, the FDA allowed this, and sometime in the early 70s, scientists started doing studies and saying, you know, if you pile all these antibiotics on these animals, you're going to generate antibiotic-resistant bacteria. This is not rocket science. And the FDA ignored them for about four decades until finally in 2013, the Centers for Disease Control came out with a definitive study showing an alarming increase in both in community-acquired antibiotic-resistant disease, meaning acquired from places other than in hospitals. So only last year, after all those decades, did the FDA finally say, pretty please, they didn't require it, it's all voluntary, they said, pretty please, will you livestock people please quit using antibiotics for growth promotion? But then they said, it's okay if you get a prescription from a veterinarian, you can continue to use them for disease prevention. Well, they hire these veterinarians. So all I got to do is go over across the hall and say, give me a script for dousing these animals out here in antibiotics. And so there's absolutely no change occurring. There may be a little bit reduced use of antibiotics, but any meat you get in a grocery store that is raised in confinement is highly likely to contain antibiotic-resistant bacteria. There's also another major failure that I'll mention, too, is that in 1946, the FDA agreed to allow companies to feed their chickens arsenic. And the theory was that this is an organic form of arsenic, which at the time they did not think caused poisoning or cancer like inorganic forms do. So in 1946, the chicken industry started feeding their chickens arsenic because it promoted growth because it killed off parasites in their digestive system. So that's 46, some 70 years later, some scientists decided to actually test this theory. And what they found was that after the chickens were fed this organic arsenic, it changed to inorganic arsenic in the digestive system. So it's been spread all over the fields and gotten into streams and onto the meat. So Consumer Reports went in and tested some chicken and found all this inorganic arsenic. So 2 years ago, FDA says, pretty please, will the livestock industry please quit feeding this arsenic to chickens? So the big guy, I forget which one of the big chemical companies, said, okay, we'll quit doing that. 70 years after they gave permission. These are just two of major failures of the FDA. And, you know, if you want, I can get into somewhat of why that is, I think, in the way they do things.
All right. Let me come back to that a minute. First, I just want to mention the scope of food poisoning. And it was in one article indicated, and I think this coincides with what you said, and I'll have you give some statistics, but on annual basis, there's approximately 48 million people in the United States alone who get food poisoning each year, with approximately 128,000 of those being hospitalized. So let me have you expand on that, because you had some figures.
Yeah, I went to this CDC website, and they have it broken down into various diseases or the sources, and one of these is salmonella. There was an average in the last several years of 900 outbreaks a year in the United States of salmonella poisoning. So that kind of puts into perspective the Chipotle's incident. And E. coli is about 500 instances a year. So you're absolutely right. You basically said the same thing in terms of total number of people poisoned. But the problem is that there's also a problem with imports from other countries that may not have quite the standards, actually our standards aren't that great, but they may even have weaker standards of sanitation in the field and so on. And they, in the last 10 years, the statistics show, the FDA actually examines about 1% of imported produce. So there is not a high degree of protection of our food supply by the FDA.
Okay. Now, one thing that I read was that, well, in relation to Chipotle, they had traced the sources of the salmonella and they traced the sources of the norovirus. They were not able to trace the source of the E. coli, it said.
Correct.
And yet the FDA said the threat is over. How do they know the threat is over in terms of those incidents if they don't know where it came from?
Well, in those particular, there's a difference between these incidences and whether there's a systematic problem. As far as these incidences are concerned, they just look at the reports, and the reports will start on some day, like in November. They'll start getting them, and then they'll ramp up, and then they'll start sliding off. And when they slide off to zero, they assume that the incident is over. Now, if they keep getting from the same company or the same outlet one outbreak after another, you've got a systematic problem. So they have announced that these, the norovirus, the salmonella, E. coli instances, chipotles are over. And since then, they had this meeting with all, you know, to improve safety. The norovirus outbreak was because they traced it to, they think, a worker or two that came to work sick. The salmonella outbreak was traced, they think, to tomatoes, and E. coli, they can't tell, but they're still pretty sure it was from chipotles because a large percentage, like 80%, if I recall correctly, of the people reporting being sick had also reported eating at Chipotle's in the week or two before. So that's how they're, even though they haven't, they tested the counters in the restaurants, they tested some of the food they had and didn't actually see the same pathogen, but that often happens. It's a transitory thing, maybe a bad batch or something. So they didn't exactly pin it on any particular food item, but they're still pretty sure it was Chipotle's.
Now, I know in the past when I've seen on some of these, especially salmonella, when it's involved vegetables, it seems like raw spinach has been a really common source. Is there something about certain vegetables that make them more susceptible, or is it strictly what's happening in the field, or what?
Well, based on what I know about it, like there was a few instances that were widely reported of organic vegetables being contaminated, and that was like it's been several years ago or maybe even as much as 7 or 8 years ago. And they felt that the reason for that was that livestock or even wildlife got into the fields and contaminated some of the growing plants. And then the washing system, you know, all this stuff has to be washed, was not sufficient to stop it. So a lot of the, and this was a big organic farm in California. That's where we get a lot of our, if you go to the grocery store and buy organic greens, whether it's spinach or lettuce, it's going to 9 out of 10 times come from California. And it's really industrial scale organic. And those are the ones where there's been a few instances, but there's no difference in the risk of livestock or wildlife getting into the field, and on whether it's organic or the vast numbers of inorganic vegetables grown out there. So that's all I know. There's the other problem is that you've got field workers, and if they don't have proper sanitation, they can also, when they're handling it, they can also introduce a pathogen. And so we were really relying on the companies to have an adequate washing system. And I always, I don't care where I get it, I always wash it again myself.
Well, and that brings up an interesting thing relating to restaurants. I read like norovirus is mostly spread through people who have the stomach flu. Mm-hmm. And they talked about hand washing requirements. It's required in several places, in most places. But, I mean, there's been numerous times when I've walked into a restroom and either they're out of soap or they're out of paper towels. So obviously if they're out of soap, the employees are not complying with the rule. And if they're out of paper towels, my guess is the employees are drying their hands on their clothes and going back to work. So should we be worried about eating out any place because of this?
Yes. I mean, I'm observant of those kinds of things as well. I mean, you see that sign, and every time you go into the bathroom, and every once in a while, there's no soap. You're right. I agree. And I start worrying about that restaurant. So, and I think the Kansas City Health Department, though, does a fairly good job. They're pretty strict on restaurants, and they go in and inspect and make reports of any glaring deficiencies. So, no, there's a risk in eating anything anywhere, even in your own home. if you don't take precautions. Now, particularly with meat, I mean, like I said, I remember one of the funniest cartoons I ever saw was after it became more known about antibiotic-resistant bacteria. There was a cartoon of a housewife dressed in a hazmat suit in front of a carving, you know, carving table, carving up a piece of meat. And there's a certain truth to that, you know. I wouldn't touch the stuff out of a grocery store. I get the meat I eat directly from farmers, because I do believe that the small, in fact, that's a known fact that if you get free range meat, it isn't 100% sure to be uncontaminated. But these animals are processed one at a time, very carefully, generally humanely, and so there's much less chance of getting cross contamination as opposed to a massive slaughterhouse where they have a assembly line moving at so many animals per minute, and it's very dangerous environment for workers, and so there's totally different atmosphere that where the animals are processed when it's industrial versus local and free range.
Now, one of the things that I've been wondering about with all these outbreaks is maybe this is a myth. I always thought that if you cook the food well done, that it's supposed to kill all this bacteria.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I don't...
So some of these chains end just not cooking their food long enough?
Well, there's, you know, you can go to a restaurant and say, how do you want it prepared? And some people will be rare or extra rare. I would never eat it that way. But there's all one other really important difference is in if you're going to a hamburger place or you're going to get hamburger, the industrial processors, this may be hard for you to believe, but it's true, that they mix together the meat from 100 different animals so that in this massive machinery, then they ship it in big blobs to McDonald's or whatever. It only takes one animal to be contaminated, and the whole batch is. But if you've got a steak, that contamination is not generally inside, it's on the outside because it wasn't ground up and mixed. So the risk of contamination on a steak is considerably less, but still, I would never order. Well, I don't eat steaks anymore because I don't like slabs of meat anymore. But you know, a lot of people do, and I would not recommend eating rare meat, particularly no rare fish either. Fish is a whole nother ball game. So.
And I read a couple of ways that they suggest minimizing the problems, at least at home. And one of the things, and Chipotle listed this as one of the things they're doing at they're centralizing where they treat the food, and they're blanching the food, mm-hmm. or some of it. And one of the things including that they're blanching like avocados, and it mentioned they've blanched stuff with the skin on. Well, I've always done it, like if I'm blanching some fruit, I've always peeled the fruit first if it's stuff that I don't eat the skin before I put it in the refrigerator or the freezer after blanching it. So is there a reason why it needs to be blanched before you take the skin off, or is that just the matter, just their own preference?
I would go with the way you're doing it because the trouble with an avocado can have a rough skin, and it could be tougher for the high temperature, humidity or whatever to get in there to the pores to kill something in there. So I think if it were me, I would go the way you do and take the skin off. In fact, that's one of the things they do in industrial chicken processing is they dump them into a vat of chlorine. But then they still found that they were contaminated because there's all these pores in the skin of these carcasses of the chickens, and the chlorine didn't get to it. So there's another reason why the skin can often continue to harbor bacteria even after they're processed.
And what about irradiation? Is that effective? Is there?
It is almost not done anymore.
Okay.
But I would not eat anything with irradiation, and the reason is because if whatever's on it, whatever bugs or bacteria, you're basically mutating those animals or those little bugs when you irradiate them, and they can change into or they can actually generate chemicals that could be toxic. So, okay. But nobody, the irradiation of meat is rare anymore.
All right. I want to thank you. For those just joining us, you've been listening to Craig Volland, who has been my guest, and we've been talking about food contamination. For those who are interested, I can suggest, too, that you go to Kansas, Missouri, and Overland Park, and I think Kansas, Kansas, all their health departments all have websites where they do restaurant inspections, and all the restaurant inspection reports, every single one they do, is online. So if you want to see what particular restaurant you go to, if they are doing what they're supposed to be doing or not doing, you can go to one of those sites if you're interested. So thank you, Craig.
Right.
Hi, I'm Dr. Christian DeQuincy, author of Blind Spots. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how common cliches distort our understanding of science, philosophy, and spirituality.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
On the next Radioactive magazine, Dr. Nathan Madden, Ph.D. in political science, and Radioactive magazine host Brian Nolan discuss Cooling the Burn, Bernie Sanders' big problems. They will also provide an election update after Hillary Clinton's and Donald Trump's upset victories on March 15th. Tune in, Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday, 6 p.m.
An interview with Dr. Tyrone Hayes. He is an American biologist and professor of integrated biology at the University of California near Berkeley, and is known for his research findings that the herbicide atrazine emasculates and feminizes male frogs. Hear his story on Sprouts Thursday at noon.
The Riverfront City by the Lake on this current cast. The Windy City's rivers, the Chicago, Calumet, and Des Plaines, made it a center of commerce by providing a way to transport goods and move wastewater away from downtown. But pollution was the price.
That history is a part of us, but we need to get beyond that a little bit and start telling a story about what the rivers are today and what they can become.
That's Josh Ellis of the Chicago Metropolitan Planning Council. He says now, as the city continues cleaning the water, it's outlining a vision for its rivers. Called Great Rivers Chicago, the initiative includes ideas like a continuous riverfront trail and more pedestrian bridges, things to help residents take as much pride in the rivers as they do Chicago's famous lakefront. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Celebrate Women's History Month with the women leaders of Stand Up KC, who are leading the fight for 15 and union rights for low-wage workers. Join them Thursday, March 24th for a free screening of the film Standing on My Sister's Shoulders and a guest speaker at the Tivoli Theater. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Film starts at 7. Following the film, hear from special out-of-town guest Rosalind Pellis. Please RSVP by emailing info@standupkc.org. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Two Pakistani women who joined the Sisters of Loretto are trained in solar technologies. They now run a mission west of Lahore, helping people become energy independent. Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
And welcome back. This is Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy, and Sarah Taliaferro is our guest for the second half of the program. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, certainly. So Sarah is here to talk about it's the heating up, artists respond to climate change series of events, I guess it is, right?
Yes, that's
happening,
right.
In Lawrence. Want to tell us about that?
Certainly. So the main event for this heating up, artists respond to climate change, is an art exhibit that is being held at the Lawrence Percolator in Lawrence, Kansas, and that will run from March 25th to April 23rd. And the final Friday event is this coming Friday from 5 to 10. Yes.
So when you say final Friday, that's a big art weekend in Lawrence.
For Lawrence, right, that's right. That Friday, there are a lot of galleries and shops that have gallery space and whatnot throughout the city that are open, kind of around the downtown and the warehouse district area.
So in the context of your event, Final Friday is actually opening day or
yes, it's our kickoff. And so we have a series of events on that night. I also want to mention that at the Watkins Museum downtown in Lawrence is the Hang 12, an artist group of high school students. And they, too, in conjunction with our exhibit, are showing some of their own work that they've made with recycled materials. And it's an excellent show, too. We're pretty excited about that.
So we do have this posted on the KKFI.org website. Is it on our Facebook page as well? And so, looks like it's up there. But we will repeat it again in a little bit. But I want to find out, how did this come about? Why have artists focus on climate?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think it's because artists have a new way of framing and telling the story, and telling that story is important. We actually started this, or the seed for this, was planted well over a year ago, back in September of 2014. One of the two organizations that have been the major planners in this event is the Lawrence Field Office of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a national, non-federal, people-powered movement. And the USDAC put out a call to all of their field offices across the United States to do some kind of action in conjunction with the People's Climate March that was happening in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So we held our own event, and it kind of grew. We worked in conjunction with the other group that's involved in this show, which is LETUS, or Lawrence Eco Teams United in Sustainability. And Haskell Indian Nations University got involved too. So it's kind of an organic process, but we had art making and a lot of speeches and prayers and whatnot in our park downtown.
And so did you know, there was a specific call out to artists? Are most of the artists from the Lawrence area? Or
a lot of them are, or they were originally,
right,
and they moved away. We have one artist who's now in Western Kansas, but the majority of the people are in or around Lawrence or have some affiliation or some connection.
So the organization you mentioned, LETUS, that's one of the co-organizers
of
the
correct
event?
That's correct, yes.
LETUS, is that a primarily a group of faith organizations? Or?
It is. It's eco teams from different churches and from the Lawrence Jewish Community Center and some meeting groups like the Mennonites.
Mm-hmm.
And right, so there are a lot of actions both within the churches and then educating the congregations for action.
Okay, and so, how did the various groups get together? I'm still trying to get a handle on.
Sure, and I didn't really explain that, did I?
No, that's okay.
So after that initial event where those two groups collaborated, we had a series of talks talking about the science of climate change, and then talking about the effects locally and then what you can do about it. We kind of noticed that a lot of the people that attended that, we were sort of preaching to all the people who were already activists. So we started talking about how do we reach out and make this more of a community-wide conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a variety of initiatives came out of that, and I was with the group who wanted to do art making or art to start that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how this exhibit and all the things that are associated with it started.
Okay, well that's great. And I want our listeners to know that on KKFI's homepage right now, We used one of the images that you sent with the press release, Justin Marable's
piece. Yes.
Piece. So that is on. You can see that on under the KK Eco Radio episode, and it's on. Right now it's on KKFI's homepage, and that's a real neat piece right there. And some of the other ones you sent us, it looks like you've got some really spectacular pieces of art.
We're really excited about all the art that's there, and a lot of the art was delivered this weekend, so we've been looking at it and sitting with it and organizing it. I wanted to tell you a little bit about another piece, a couple pieces that came. One of them is a beehive that was made by a professor at KU and a handful of his students, and it's functional, and so I heard you mentioning the honeybee populations and pollinators and butterflies, and so that's kind of making a home for those dwindling populations of mm-hmm. pollinators. And another piece that we have, there's an invasive aquatic plant species that actually people had in their aquariums, and then people dumped their aquariums, and it's a Eurasian milfoil. And one of the artists, Marin Abel, has harvested this, and he's made a 9-foot-long flat-bottom trolling motorboat complete with serpent heads that he made out of this milfoil, and then he put resin over it.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that's that. He installed a lot of video and film clips about that and some art about that. But the boat, which is called a hydra, he calls it a hydra, that will actually be sitting out front of the percolator this Friday. So if you want to see it in person.
Oh, that's great. And the percolator, where is that?
The percolator is a cooperative art gallery that is between New Hampshire and Rhode Island streets in Lawrence, just off the main drag on 9th Street, just south of 9th Street. It's actually faces the alley in between those two streets.
Okay.
It's a real neat space.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I haven't been there myself, but I've heard of other things that sounded very provocative and interesting exhibits there. And so that piece that you just described will be on display outside there on Friday?
Yes, just this Friday.
And which is part of the final Friday art walk.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. And so So for Final Friday, it's the opening at the percolator, and is the Watkins Museum also that
yes.
same night?
It is. And they're walking distance from each other, but yes, both of those shows open on Final Friday. So the Hang 12 exhibit and the Heating Up exhibit, yes.
So the Hang 12 exhibit, is that climate-related, environmentally
yes.
related?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so why Hang 12? Is it 12 pieces, or why is it called Hang 12? Do you know?
It's the name of the group, and I actually don't know how many high school students are in it, and they have a sponsor, and it's through the Lawrence Arts Center.
Okay.
A really talented group of students. So we wanted to try to get as many different groups in the community involved in this, so we approached them, and they were delighted, and so they're actually holding their own show. Hang 12 exhibits a new show every month around town in different venues. So they picked this, and this one does have an environmental theme to go with Heating Up. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Yeah, it's really important to bring the kids in, you know, and that sounds like a fascinating thing. And then, so what, it sounds like the big hoopla is this Friday, but what else will be going on? Or is there other things going on Friday that we haven't mentioned?
There are other things going on Friday. Just with that opening reception, there will be poetry readings and spoken word and music, the performances that will happen throughout the evening.
Okay.
And so there's that. And then there are other events. There will be a writing workshop, which will be April 17th at the Percolator
okay.
from 2 to 4. And so that will be, there'll be a naturalist and a writer and a poet laureate writer team of Karen Miriam Goldberg and Ken Lassman, and they'll be running that workshop. There is a dance and poetry performance that will be held on April 15th. So I'm kind of walking backward in time here from, and that will be from, there will be two performances at 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. And it's called Mrs. Noah in Poetry and Dance. And it's the poet Elizabeth Schultz and the dancer Joan Stone. They're reflecting on relationships among humans and animals. And then backing up a little bit more, back toward Final Friday, we have a panel discussion that's called How Can We Work Together on Climate Change? And I'm pretty excited about that event, too. That will be at Haskell Indian Nations University on April 10th from 3 to 5. And we'll have a group of panelists, which includes Sarah Lynn Reese-Hardy, who's the director of the Spencer Museum of Art, Thad Holcomb, who's a retired Ecumenical Christian Ministries campus minister and eco-activist, and he will be joined by Eileen Horn, who is the climate and energy, she's the climate sustainability coordinator for Douglas County and the City of Lawrence, and she was formerly with the Climate and Energy Project and with Interfaith Power and Light, Kansas. The Kansas chapter. There's Jay Johnson, who's an associate professor of associate chair of geography and atmospheric science at KU, and he directs KU's Center for Indigenous Research, Science and Technology. Dan Wildcat, who's a professor at Haskell Indian Nations University, and he's the director of the Haskell Environmental Research Studies Center, and he's the convener of the American Indian Alaska Native Climate Change Working Group. Okay. So yes, that'll be a really exciting.
That sounds like something that Eco Radio should be at, and
I would love that. Yeah,
and possibly record for possible broadcast. That sounds like that might be a good thing for. And that looks really interesting, and so it sounds like a lot going on. So we've just got like another 3 minutes here. So we want to make sure that we get out information we haven't gotten out yet that you think is important. We want to, and then repeat the, you know, the contact info, websites, and all that. And
Well, the last event that I didn't mention already, which is on Saturday, April 16th at Haskell, the Eco Ambassadors, Haskell students, are doing a Haskell Wetlands Restoration Day, and public can bring garden gloves and trowels and whatever else and join in doing some planting and restoration work at the wetlands. So
that's great.
Yeah.
So just winding up, where if people want to look up all this information, I think we posted it on kkfi.org on tonight's episode. Do you have a website that you want to direct people to? I think I saw maybe lettuce.wordpress.com that I...
Yes, there's a Facebook event page which you can get through that WordPress site through Lettuce. And I don't know how to translate that into a thing on air, but
right.
But yeah. The Lawrence Ecology Team's wordpress.com/about. You can also, the USDAC National Office has blogs and postings about the events as well.
Right, that's where I'm getting it. Lawrence Ecology Teams.wordpress.com.
Yes.
Looks like it has a lot of pretty much
that's
all
kind
the info
of the main one
go.
That it goes through, but there are Facebook pages for event pages for each of the separate events.
Well, that's outstanding. So, Sarah Taliaferro, thank you so much for coming in here.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I hope you do come over on April 10th.
Yeah, we would like to make that happen, and thanks again, and keep us posted what's going on there. We'd like to let our listeners know.
Absolutely.
All right, now we're going to turn it over to Natural E for our calendar of events, and we'll close out with This Week in Water.
Thank you, Mike. There's a volunteer pickup on March 26th from 9 a.m. to noon. This spring, Bridging the Gap is hosting volunteer litter pickups to help protect our waterways. Volunteers will pick up litter along streams in Johnson County and learn about how litter affects the local, regional, and global watershed. The exact locations are to be determined, but all volunteers will get a free t-shirt and have a chance to win a 55-gallon rain barrel. Bridging the Gap will provide the supplies. Additional volunteer litter pickups will be held April 2nd, 16th, and 23rd. But this one coming up is March 26th, and it's from 9 to noon. And you can find more information by seeing the event on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Planning your plot for garden success, April 1st at noon. It's hosted by the Kansas City Community Gardens. The Planning Your Plot for Garden Success workshop will share how to create a planting plan to help maximize garden space, get more vegetables, and save time and money. KCCG has developed some new tools to help you create a garden plan and shopping list for spring, summer, and fall. This free event will be held at noon on Friday, April 1st at 6917 Kensington in Kansas City, Missouri. The workshops are free, but space is limited, so make sure you RSVP. And again, the link is on our Eco Radio Facebook page. Project Blue River Rescue, April 2nd, from 8 a.m. to noon. Volunteers of all ages and abilities are needed to clean up the Blue River. Dedicated sites are available for groups. T-shirts, work gloves, tools, and trash bags will be provided. Also, donuts and coffee will be available at sign-in. And volunteers will meet back at the Lakeside Nature Center for lunch at noon. It's from 8 to noon on Saturday, April 2nd at the Lakeside Nature Center, which is located at 4701 East Gregory Boulevard. Visit lakesidenaturecenter.org for more information. The Eat Local and Organic Expo Kansas City is coming up on April 2nd from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Meet and buy directly from local organic and free-range farmers and vendors at Kansas City Food Circle's annual Eat Local and Organic Expo. Snatch up early seedlings, fresh greens, free-range meat and eggs, and get KCFC's free directory of local organic and free-range producers. Getting a CSA subscription to a farm gives access to some of the freshest food in town. Some farmers can accept credit cards and checks, but cash is preferred. Families are welcome. KCFC holds two expos. The one on April 2nd is at Johnson County Community College, and then at Penn Valley Community College on April 9th. You can find the Kansas City Food Circle online. And lastly, I'd just like to remind everybody about the event they were just speaking about, Heating Up, Artists Respond to Climate Change. That's March 25th from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Lawrence Percolator, which is at 913 Rhode Island in Lawrence, Kansas.
Guantanamo Nature Preserve and Russian spy dolphins? Those and other stories for the week ending March 20th, 2016.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
President Barack Obama arrives in Cuba this Sunday for a historic visit as the first sitting U.S. president to travel to the island in 88 years.
The trip comes 57 years after the 1959 revolution that overthrew the pro-American Batista government and put Fidel Castro in power. The U.S. imposed a punishing economic embargo on the island, hoping to bring about hunger, despair, and the overthrow of the new communist government.
While the embargo caused hardship, it never achieved its aim. The Obama administration has made efforts to rescind it, but have been blocked by the Republican-led Congress. Instead, the president has used his executive authority to loosen trade and travel restrictions.
Even as the U.S. and Cuba move toward restoring diplomatic relations, there's the thorny issue of the Guantanamo Bay military base. Following exposés of rendition and torture, Obama has repeatedly promised to close down the detention facility at Gitmo, and Cuba maintains that until the U.S. gives up the base, full normalization is impossible.
For two researchers, the solution is another revolution, but not with guns and tanks, but instead test tubes and swim fins.
Joe Roman, a conservation biologist, and James Kraska, a law professor, have proposed what they call a third path for Guantanamo, turning it into an international marine research institution in Peace Park.
In a piece published in Science magazine, the parasite pristine coral reefs, mangrove wetlands, tropical forests, and a biodiversity unparalleled in the Caribbean.
Because the island was isolated for so long, its environment has been undeveloped and undisturbed. That's allowed its coral reefs and seagrass beds to thrive, and along with it, scores of wildlife, including sharks, dolphins, whales, and an infinite number of fish.
The authors think converting the base into a woods hole of the Caribbean would be an ideal way to unite Cuba and the United States while helping meet the challenges of climate change, mass extinction, and declining coral reefs.
The dream is to make Guantanamo, a name that's been associated with terrorism and 9/11, into one meaning conservation, preservation, and cooperation.
National attention about lead in drinking water started with the crisis in Flint, Michigan.
Worry about this problem continues to grow as aging pipe systems in some schools across the country have shown levels of lead contamination.
And last week it was learned that almost 2,000 water systems across the U.S. have shown excessive levels of lead over the past 4 years.
The EPA and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention both say no amount of lead in water is safe, but an EPA standard says that suppliers must take action to reduce contamination only after lead levels rise above 15 parts per billion.
Levels of lead exceeding EPA action standards were found in water systems that altogether supply 6 million people across the country, according to the USA Today.
And what adds to people's concerns is the fact that many people were not warned as required when lead was found. 180 systems were cited for failing to notify the public, and almost half of those more than once.
The mayor of Montreal, Canada, is proposing to ban plastic water bottles from the city.
Mayor Denis Coderre stated that the bottles are an environmental nuisance, and 700 million single-use bottles end up in Quebec landfills every year.
Should the ban pass, the city of 1.5 million people would be the largest to do so in the world.
3 years ago, Concord, Massachusetts instituted a ban on water sold in plastic bottles, and now water is sold there only in paper cartons.
And more recently, San Francisco barred the sale of plastic water bottles last year.
Predictably, industry giants like Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle are all planning to fight the ban in Montreal, and the Canadian Beverage Association says that plastic bottles are safe and convenient, and eliminating them would restrict consumers' right to choose.
Last week, the Obama administration announced that it would not allow oil and gas drilling in the Atlantic off of Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia. The administration's decision was a reversal of what had been approved just a year ago.
After the administration gave a green light to oil and gas operations last year, there were many protests, notably by beach towns worried about a spill similar to the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico.
In addition to environmental opposition to new Atlantic drilling, Obama's own Department of Defense had expressed concern over seismic testing to be done by the oil industry that could have disrupted secret military training exercises.
In related news, the Obama administration also announced last week new air quality standards for offshore drilling activity for the first time in more than 3 decades.
The proposed rules are designed to rein in air emissions on everything from offshore platforms to the icebreakers operating off of Alaska.
And finally, the announcement that SeaWorld will end its controversial orca breeding program made big news last week. The move came after years of pressure by animal welfare advocates and scientists who've argued that the whales shouldn't be kept in captivity.
While a step in the right direction for orcas, things weren't looking as good for another marine mammal. A Russian government website advertised that the Ministry of Defense is looking for 5 bottlenose dolphins to bring into captivity.
To be exact, they wanted ones with perfect teeth, of average length, and possessing a willingness to display motor activity, according to a notice that's since been taken down.
The ad didn't indicate what duties the dolphins would be expected to perform, but it has rekindled speculation that Russia is reviving combat dolphin units that served as Soviet spies, investigators, rescuers, and possibly even assassins during the Cold War.
The U.S. Navy also has a marine mammal program that trains bottlenose dolphins, whales, and sea lions in helping to detect mines in deep waters, but vehemently denies that its mammals were ever used as spies or attack animals, though rumors persist.
If indeed the Cold War is heating up, then any day now we might just see Vladimir Putin bare-chested straddling two dolphins as they swim across the Crimean Sea.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Unite the world of water at AWWA's ACE 16 in Chicago, June 19th through 22nd. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE16.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
...90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. You're listening